The precision with which scientists were able to forecast the path of Hurricane Sandy was pretty remarkable. Without the advance warnings during the storm's approach, the loss of lives and the already tremendous damage would certainly have been a lot worse. Today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about the science of storm tracking, from the satellites and special planes to the computer models, and we'll consider future developments, including the question of accounting for climate change in forecasting. Joining us now are Dr. Robert Gall, Development Manager of the Hurricane Forecast Improvement Program at the NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and Dr. Adam Sobel, Professor of Applied Physics and Applied Mathematics and of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the Foo Foundation School of Engineering and Applied Science and Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we just want to remind our listeners that the mayor will be speaking at some time in the near future. We will break away to cover that that press conference. But let's try to get as much in here as we can as quickly as possible. Dr. Sobel, how do scientists define a hurricane as opposed to another kind of weather system?
Right. A hurricane is a weather system that forms in the tropics. It has a number of characteristics. It has a warm core. The air in the middle is warmer than the environment around it, whereas in an extratropical or winter-type storm, it's colder than in the environment around it. It tends to be very symmetric, circularly symmetric. That's the classic image that we see from pictures from space of the swirling blob of clouds in a circular or spiral shape with the eye in the middle. Physically, it gets its energy from the warm tropical oceans, whereas the winter-type storms or extratropical storms get their energy from the jet stream, or another way of saying it that's actually equivalent to that is that it gets its energy from the temperature gradient, the difference in temperature between the low latitudes and the polar regions.
Do hurricanes always move eastward? Because they so often make landfall along the Gulf Coast or along the east coast of the United States.
Well, hurricanes can take a number of tracks. They can move. Typically, when they first form, they're at low latitudes where the winds blow from the east to the west, which is actually westward. So normally, although it's not always the case, a hurricane early in its lifetime will be moving towards the west. But then they also tend to drift towards higher latitudes, and as they do that, they get caught up in the winds at higher latitudes, which tend to blow from the west to the east. So whether they make landfall or not depends on the shape of the coast and exactly the details of what each storm is doing. But the most typical track is from the east to the west, and then drifting north, and then moving the other way. But anything can happen in between.
Yeah, I obviously misspoke when I said they move eastward. They obviously move westward. Dr. Gall, am I right to think that there are two main measures needed to help predict the behavior of a hurricane, its track and its intensity?
Well, there's two measures that we tend to report, particularly try to forecast for the public, and that is the intensity of the storm. And there are a number of measures that we use for intensity. One is just to simply tell you how strong the winds are going to be in knots or miles per hour. The other is to make the intensity scale, you know, a little bit easier to picture. We have a category scale of 1 through 5 to describe the strength of the storm. And basically those are categories that are determined by how fast the winds are blowing.
And that's the Saffir-Simpson scale?
That's the Saffir-Simpson scale, yeah. It was developed probably 30 years ago.
So. And haven't some scientists argued that the Saffir-Simpson scale is somewhat outdated?
Well, one of the problems with the Saffir-Simpson scale, and you really did see it in this storm, this storm was a Category 1. But it produced a lot of damage. And the reason it produced a lot of damage was because it was huge. It was absolutely immense. And so it affected an area with hurricane-force winds that went all the way from south of Delaware Bay to north of New York City. And most storms, when they come on shore, are not nearly that big. So you could have, a Category 3 or a Category 4 storm coming on shore that's small, producing less damage than, say, this storm did with only a Category 1. So there has been some thought maybe of redoing it to take into account better the size of the storm.
Dr. Sobel, how were storms tracked before we had satellites? I mean, farmers used to look up at the sky and judge approaching storms. Does the amount of information available now make instinct totally irrelevant?
I don't know if it makes it irrelevant, but it certainly makes it play a secondary role. I think now we have so much information that we really know a great deal about where a storm is and what it's doing at any given time. From the satellites, certainly is probably the biggest single factor, but also once they get close to land, the aircraft and measurements made at the surface from buoys on the ocean and a lot of other sources, so that even without instinct, we know a lot. I think the role of instinct now that the forecasters, you know, comes into play when the forecaster has to look at all the different information and make judgments, given that even the computer models, as accurate as they are a little bit uncertain, and sometimes the data, you know, don't tell us everything. So there's still a role for instinct, but it's nothing like it was in the old days before satellites, when you know, if you go back far enough, nobody would know a hurricane was there unless a ship ran across it.
We're talking about the science of storm tracking today as our Please Explain segment with Drs. Adam Sobel of Columbia University and Robert Gall of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We invite your calls at 646-829-3980, or you can leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org. Dr. Gall, what happens to all of the information that's gathered? Who gathers it, and then what happens to it?
Well, there's a lot of information collected every day all over the world by every country in the world. These data are in the form of observations that are taken on the surface. You've probably seen anemometers, you know, these things with cups rotating around. They're taking measurements of the wind, for example. Those are some of the measurements we take. Every day, nations around the world send up balloons with devices on them called radio sondes, and these measure temperature, pressure, and winds as the balloon rises through the atmosphere. Planes, when you're on an airplane going across country, they're also reporting observations back from their level as they go through, as they go along their route.
Don't some planes actually fly into hurricanes, which would seem to me to be rather dangerous?
Well, I'm talking about the commercial ones. I can mention the ones on the that go into the hurricane in just a moment. And then we have satellites that that look at the atmosphere from above, and we can take those observations from satellites and infer what the atmosphere is doing. Now, all these data are put onto a thing called the Global Telecommunications System, and all this data flows in to a number of centers around the world. We have one here in Washington called the National Centers for Environmental Prediction that collect the data. And then there's a process by which all of this data then are put together into a form that we can use to run our forecast models.
And then we mentioned that there are planes that actually fly into hurricanes. You were in one of those, weren't you? What was that experience like?
I took a flight in once. And of course, all of us that are studying hurricanes, that's one of our dreams, is to see what the inside of a hurricane looks like. And I flew into one maybe 10 years ago. It was a hurricane called Danielle. My experience was probably not as great as some get, because I have a tendency to have a weak stomach. And we were out for 10 hours, and I was throwing up for 9 of them. but it's
very scientific of you.
Oh, yeah. It's not that rough, though. It's sort of a steady, constant bumping like you sometimes feel when you're flying across country, particularly over the Rockies. But it's continuous for 10 hours.
But so. Isn't the eye actually calmer than the rest of the storm?
Yeah, it can be spectacular as you break into the eye. You're in, you're surrounded by cloud, and the plane is bumping along, and then you break through the eye wall and come out into the eye, and all of a sudden it's clear and relatively calm. And it's like a great big stadium around you with sloping, you know, sloping clouds going off in all directions.
Dr. Sobel, How scientific are the United States' current systems for measuring weather and storms, and things like hurricanes, compared to other nations?
First of all, it's important to recognize that a lot of the routine meteorological data that Dr. Gall mentioned, like the radio sondes and the satellite data, that's actually shared across the world by all the nations, which is a way in which I think our field meteorology is ahead of a lot of others, because it was recognized from the beginning of weather forecasting that that the weather doesn't care where the national boundaries are. And so we have a good tradition of sharing data. It's not always perfect, but it's really, really quite good, I think. But in terms of specifically for hurricanes, my understanding is that the U.S. is probably has the best systems. Of course, Europe doesn't really get hit by hurricanes, but the West Pacific, East Asian countries do, as well as Australia and a lot of other places. And I think certainly our aircraft reconnaissance is the best in the world. Most other regions don't have that. You know, in other words, the flights we were just Dr. Gall was just talking about, where the aircraft are specifically flying to hurricanes to make measurements. So I think we can always do better, but I think the U.S. systems are probably the best.
Although there was an article in yesterday's New York Times, rather scary, about what we are looking forward to in the next few years, and we'll address that when we come back. My guests are Dr. Adam Sobel, Professor of Applied Physics and Applied Mathematics and of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the Foo Foundation School of Engineering and Applied Science and the Mont-Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. Couldn't you have a briefer title, Dr. Sobel? Dr. Robert Gall is Development Manager of the Hurricane Forecast Improvement Program at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. We will be back right after this. We are back with today's Please Explain look at the science of storm tracking with Dr. Robert Gall of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and Dr. Adam Sobel of Columbia University. I mentioned an article in yesterday's Times, I don't know if you saw it, Dr. Gall, it said that weather forecasters were able to predict the track of Hurricane Sandy with increasing accuracy as it moved up the Atlantic coast and then turned west to make landfall on the coast of New Jersey and then veered north toward Canada, which allowed communities to prepare for the worst and evacuate where necessary. But it warned that capability will be lost in just a few years because many of the satellites are very much past their prime. How serious is this problem?
Well, if we lose the satellites, we do lose a lot of the data that we used in our models to make these forecasts. Give you an example, there's a geostationary satellite called GOES, G-O-E-S, geostationary, I forget the rest of the acronym, satellite, that is the one that provides most of the pictures that we see of the clouds, or the satellite pictures you see on television. It failed about 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago. Now, fortunately, there was one that was just basically parked up there as a spare, and they moved it over so it could cover our area. But if we didn't have that capability, we wouldn't have been able to do anywhere near as well as we did with tracking Sandy.
The Times said mismanagement in federal budget cuts over the past decade are a reason for the problem. These polar satellites are nearing or already beyond their working lives, and the next launch for a replacement satellite is scheduled at the moment at the year 2017. It was put off to then. Does that mean we'll have a few years with limited ability to track storms?
I suspect not. We actually get a lot of satellite data. We do have to maintain what we have, and that's critical. As I said, I think a lot of the skill that we saw in this storm comes from the data that we get from satellites. There are other sources of data, but those are the ones that give us the most complete coverage. There are backups. I mentioned the one for the geostationary satellite. And there are several orbiters up there, or polar orbiters up there, that potentially could cover if one or two of them fail. If they all fail, then we're in real trouble.
Well, your boss pledged to fix what he's called this dysfunctional program that had become a national embarrassment due to chronic management problems.
Yeah, I can't really speak to the management issues here. I'm not that familiar with them.
Have you been following this, Dr. Sobel?
From a distance, just enough to be, you know, as distressed about it as whoever wrote the New York Times article. But I'm no expert on the management either.
We invite your calls, listener calls, to 646-829-3980. That's 646-829-3980. You can also leave a question or a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Isn't there another storm, exactly what we don't need right now, that's being forecast to hit sometime next week or around the time of the election?
I was just looking at our forecasts. There's a winter storm that should form off the East Coast in about a week, but that's not a hurricane, and it should, looks like it'll stay offshore. It was also showing a storm forming in the East Atlantic, very low probability, maybe less than 20% possibility of a hurricane system. It's kind of far north if it happens, and my guess is it won't. Other than that, I don't see anything as far as hurricanes on the horizon for the next week.
Well, the Washington Post reported the Euro, which sniffed out Sandy 8 days before it hit, shows an area of low pressure developing off the Georgia-South Carolina coast the night of the election, moving up the coast into New England by Wednesday night.
Yeah, that's that winter storm that I talked about.
Yeah, actually, I was looking at the maps, and that one looks, the situation looks a lot like what it was with Sandy, except that there's no hurricane there. Yeah. In other words, the rest of it is somewhat somewhat similar. So I think the storm we'll see will be much like what we would have had if Sandy hadn't been there, except that it'll be looks like it might be a little colder, even a chance of some of the precipitation might be frozen. But I think I agree. I don't think it would be something that would normally be a big disaster, except that if a lot of people still don't have power, it might be a little unpleasantly cold.
A listener writes in, Will in Chelsea, why did Sandy begin its life in Central America, and what atmospheric conditions put it on its path? Is that true? Don't hurricanes all begin off the coast of Africa?
No. There tends to be the season tends to change for where the hurricane forms as you go through the season. The early ones tend to form in the Gulf, and then about mid-July, the primary genesis area are from systems that come off of Africa. So they tend to form in the south part of the Atlantic, north of the equator. Somewhere between the islands of the Caribbean and the African coast, and there are structures called easterly waves that come across, and some of them occasionally develop into hurricanes. Later in the season, it switches to the Caribbean, and this is where Sandy came from. She came out of the Caribbean, and in this case, went straight north.
Mm-hmm. And this is all because as the north gets colder, the storm systems form in warmer climes.
Well, they don't. You need a minimum water minimum water temperature of about 26 or 27 degrees centigrade, so around 80 degrees Fahrenheit. If the temperatures are colder than that, it won't form a hurricane. And so, part of the reason you have a hurricane season is you have to wait for the Atlantic Ocean to get warm enough to sustain hurricanes. I think the reason the season shifts from the African storms to the Caribbean storms is the waves that are coming off Africa basically stop or get weaker later in the season. So either they take a lot longer to get across the Atlantic or it's something else that's forming them.
Well, a number of people have pointed out that that climate change maybe is warming the oceans. There also was this cold front that came from the north that seemed rather unusual, creating this the intensity of this storm. Do you see climate change, either of you, as a possible exacerbator of these storms in the future?
Well, I think it's a subtle question that a lot of us are struggling with. I think one thing we have to remember, some years ago, a lot of us thought that, well, because tropical cyclones need a warm ocean to form, as the ocean gets warmer, we should have more of them. It's not quite as simple as that, because that the threshold that Dr. Gall mentioned of 26 or 27 centigrade is the threshold in the current climate. But really, the physics of tropical cyclones, we think, is such that what really matters is the temperature difference between the atmosphere and the ocean, or another way to see it is the temperature difference between the warmest places and everywhere else. So what that means is that if the whole climate warms, then we think that the threshold that it takes to form a tropical cyclone, some of us expect anyway, that will go up as well. And so it isn't clear that a warmer ocean will support necessarily, if the whole world ocean warms, in other words, that we'll have more tropical cyclones. And in fact, the latest models, which are still not perfect, but a lot better than the previous ones were, are in some measure of agreement that in a warmer climate we'll see more likely fewer tropical cyclones rather than a greater number of them, but that the ones there are will be more intense. And so whether the total number of the most intense ones goes up or down is not obvious, because fewer storms but more intense ones, it's not obvious whether you'll get more over any given intensity threshold. And then the other factors, like the cold temperature of the cold front coming down from the north, or the blocking high over Greenland that made the path so unusual, which was really the most unusual thing about Sandy. There have been various ways that those factors have been connected to climate change, and those are have varying degrees of uncertainty with them. So I think the bottom line is that an event like this could happen without climate change, but we can't rule out that a warming climate will make them more probable. There's too much that we don't understand to be able to say that, and there's too many different ways in which we think that a warming climate will support extreme weather. I think whenever we say this, we have to repeat the most simple one, which is that we do expect with great confidence that the warming climate will make the sea level rise at some rate or other, but possibly as much as a few feet in the next century. And that will make the storm surge, which was what was really the killer here, worse, even regardless of what happens to the storms, even if the storms don't change. So I think there's good reason to be concerned about more events like this in the future, even despite all the great uncertainties with associating any given storm to a warmer climate.
Yeah, I don't think we see any evidence yet that. Everybody agrees pretty much now that the climate is warming.
Not everyone.
Well,
we have a number of people in Congress who say it's not true.
Well, there's a lot of evidence that it's warming, okay? The question, I think, is more why. And if one argues that the climate is warming, one assumes that as the ocean warms up, you'll get more hurricanes. We have seen no evidence, no statistically significant evidence yet that this increase is occurring now. That doesn't mean it won't occur in the future.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
My guests are Drs. Robert Gall and Adam Sobel. We are talking about tracking storms as for today's Please Explain, and we invite your calls at 646-829-3980. Paula from Yardley, Pennsylvania, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. This is a slightly little bit off hurricanes, but to settle an ongoing argument with my husband. I'm from England, and we are terrified when we get nor'easters. And I hear people I've been here many years, 30, people in this country talk about nor'easters being bad. And when I say, oh, let's hope it's not a nor'easter, that's the worst weather we can get, except for hurricanes, obviously. And my husband says, oh, no, the worst winds come from the west. The worst storms come from the west. So can you settle that argument for me?
Well, you're probably both winners. The nor'easter is a storm. It's actually very much like the track of Sandy. It comes up from the south and parallels the coast. So in those storms, and they can be very strong and very windy, often produce snow in the winter. During those storms, the wind comes out of the northeast, hence the name. After the storm goes through, the winds will switch into the west, and they can still be quite strong from the west. And those west winds can last for a couple of days, slowly dying down. So, yeah, there's a lot of directions from which we can get really strong winds. So, you know, I'd say you're both right.
Thank you for your call. William from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
What's your question?
My question is, do you think that New York's high rises that go up to 90 stories could withstand the West Indian's ferocious hurricanes?
Well, I'm not an architect, but...
Specifically the windows.
Yeah, it depends on the strength of the wind. You're not likely in New York to get a Category 5 hurricane ever. And those are the kind of, you know, category 3, 4, 5, where the windows might begin to blow out.
But they're that intense often in the Caribbean.
In the Caribbean, yeah, you can get winds to 170 miles an hour, and those can do a lot of damage.
Now, one of the countries that's hard hit often is Cuba. Does politics play a role in tracking hurricanes?
You know, it's for a while. Yeah, we talked about the planes that we fly into hurricanes, and there are two groups that do that. One is the Air Force, and there's a wing of the Air Force Reserve that fly those planes. They were not allowed to fly over Cuba for many years. They may be now. I'm not sure. NOAA was allowed to fly its planes over, and so there was an interesting politics there, but they get all their forecasts from us, so they have incentive to let us take the data.
Now, a listener, Alistair from Portchester, wants to do a follow-up on that article in the New York Times that claimed that our current satellites are expected to last just a few more years, and there are, although there are plans for the next generation, there'll be a gap between them with no working satellites or a few working satellites, therefore no satellite information. What are the consequences for predicting storms like Sandy?
Well, if we didn't, as I said, a lot of the data that the forecasts are accomplished through something called a model. Everybody's probably heard the term by now. These are great mathematical things that are solved on computers, and they require data to start with. So a forecast is really starting from some point and then advancing forward in time to get a forecast of, for example, where the storm is going to go. Nowadays, I think two-thirds of the data that we use in the models comes from satellites. So if they were all to shut off, yeah, we'd be back in the dark ages. We wouldn't have had much warning for Sandy, for example. But I personally don't think it's that dire. There probably are going to be periods where some of the satellites go out, but they won't all go out.
And these satellites go from pole to pole and then scan the planet strip by strip as it passes beneath them?
There are two types of satellites that we use in weather. Those are one, they're called polar orbiting satellites, and because of that, they can see every point of the globe as they go around. And the orbits, you know, the Earth basically rotates under the orbit, so you get these little strips. And they see every point on the globe twice a day. The other kind of satellite is a geostationary satellite. They're much higher, and their orbit is exactly synced with the rotation of the Earth, so they're always over the same point. They can only see about a third of the globe at one point, any one time, and so it takes three of them to see the whole globe. But, yeah, they're both those kind of satellites are used extensively in weather.
Let's go to Donald in Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking this call. I was very intrigued by one of your speaker's comments that the commercial airline system was providing some of the data they used, and I know that they have to have a huge amount of data for their engines. How comprehensive a system is it for gathering data from the airlines around the world?
I think the airline aircraft, all have a system for sending data back to a central location. It includes other things about the performance of the aircraft. But all we're asking for from the aircraft are estimates of wind temperature, pressure, and humidity. And so those are fairly small amounts of data. For us, it's big because it adds a lot of data to what we have available.
Thank you. I hadn't realized that was taking place.
Yeah. Every time you fly, you're helping contribute to a better weather forecast.
And global warming at the same time.
Yeah, there you go.
Michael from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? One of the gentlemen said that as the oceans are, or that whatever the cause, the oceans are rising. And if that is indeed, and they said that, therefore, we're going to have much greater damage. My question, I guess, is it because of our current infrastructure, meaning the levees are built to a certain level, our protection levels are built to a certain level to apprehend the current storm surge? Is that something we can look forward to and build towards, or is this completely atmospheric and climatic?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, the water, the sea level is what it is, and our society lives where it does in response to that. And so as the sea level rises, we have two choices. One is to move inland, and the other is to build higher seawalls or some other kind of defenses. And so, you know, that's the choice we're facing, I think. I mean, and how quickly we'll have to do it, we don't know, because the big unknown is how fast the ice on land on Greenland and Antarctica will melt, and that we don't understand that well. But it's pretty certain that as the climate warms, the sea level will rise at some rate, and then as it happens, even if there weren't any change in hurricanes, which I don't think we know exactly what the change will be, but we don't need to know in order to be concerned, because even if the hurricanes stay the same, if you add the storm surge from a hurricane of today onto a higher basic sea level, the water will be higher. So we have to adapt to that in some way or other, or we'll just keep being flooded like we are now.
Now, will seawalls even be able to withstand the power of a hurricane like Sandy?
Well, you mean in terms of the wind? I mean, I think in terms of the surge, there's the waves, but the surge itself is just the sea level getting higher.
On the North Sea, you see a seawall that is now all crumbled into the North Sea because of the power of the water that's been hitting it year after year. I'd assume something similar would happen here. Thank you all both so much for being with us. Dr. Robert Gall of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, Dr. Adam Sobel of Columbia University.